So they're being exposed to high concentrations of contaminated dust all the time. And they don't know that. And it all kind of came from a Spanish colonial mercury mine, essentially the largest mercury mine in the Western Hemisphere in Huancavelica, Peru.
Welcome to the Near and Far podcast. I'm your host, Zachary Ellis, and this show is all about embracing curiosity, leaping beyond your comfort zones, and learning from adventurers like yourself who have traveled near and far. Today's guest is Bryn Toms, who ventures to mining sites in both Peru and the Pacific Northwest to clean up mercury contamination and protect the health of downstream communities. Welcome to the show, Bryn.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So before you began working for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, before you began traveling to Peru to clean up mining disasters, you, I understand, had quite the cultural exchange as a young person.
Yeah, so when I was younger, probably around, I guess it was in the early 80s, there was a Eritrean refugee crisis. My parents, growing up in Portland, Oregon, my parents had somehow got connected with a refugee community, and my family hosted two Eritrean refugees that both were, I think they were in the military in Eritrea, and anyway, it sounded like they came from a pretty awful situation, but we had these two folks living with us for 3 months. My brother and I were probably, I think we were probably about, 11 or 12 years old. And it was quite an experience. I don't think, you know, after 3 months, I don't think we still really ever were able to communicate in their language, or they didn't really know English that well. But we basically lived with these two fellows, and it was a really neat experience. I look back at that time, and I think of it as being a very kind of, it just was very foundational for me when it comes to thinking about other cultures. We didn't really speak their language. We didn't really need to, and we all became really good friends, and we enjoyed spending time with their community. We would go to the community events, and they'd make dorawat, which was an amazing spicy chili stew type thing, and I think eating that, from then on, I think I became totally infatuated with spicy foods at a young age, and so, anyway, yeah, it was a neat experience.
Wow, it's hard enough to become friends with people when you can speak the same language. That must have been... Were there any complications, or I'm not even sure what I'm trying to ask here, but living in the same house as people that you can't communicate with, how did that work out?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There was definitely one incident that I recall pretty specifically. In Eritrea, the snakes there, I think, are mostly venomous. And we were working in the garden quite a bit in the summertime. My dad was really into gardening, and my brother and I would be out there with these two guys. And we would be scalping some soil or turning some soil or whatever we needed to do to get a garden bed going. And there was we came across a garter snake. One of the guys instantly wanted to try to kill it because he thought it was poisonous. And my brother and I both were like, no, it's okay. You don't need to kill this poor snake. It's a small little yellow back, you know, racer or something like that. That was hard to explain because I think, like I said, they didn't speak English and we didn't speak Eritrean. And so it was really hard for us to communicate. But it, you know, I think the guy kind of figured it out. I mean, it was ingrained in this person to basically be scared of all snakes just because I think they live around mostly venomous snakes. So, but, you know, other than that. Yeah, I mean, we had dinners together and working out, you know, time frames and things like that. And, you know, I don't know, it all seemed to work out. They just kind of knew, they kind of got used to the system that they were living in.
And in my experience, I think we've chatted before about how the more you explore what makes us different, the more we all realize that we have so much in common.
Yeah, for sure.
Like the love of spicy food. First, how did your parents even get connected to this program?
I do not know. My father was a professor at Portland State University, and I should say that he did have students that were from the Middle East, grad students that would come to the house on occasion. So we did meet other people of other cultures, and we traveled to Italy when I was 2 years old. I don't remember that, but I went with him. And maybe that actually had some kind of formative thing that I don't realize. You know, at 2 years old, you can't really remember what was happening, but we probably did. My brother and I probably picked up a certain amount of cultural exchange being that young. I don't know if that made us more empathetic or more aware, but But yeah, I think that might have been part of the reason, just because my dad was in the university, that might have been, I don't know exactly why they got involved with the Eritrean community, the refugee
and
community.
With your experience in Italy, two-year-olds are like sponges. They just soak up every experience that's offered to them.
Yeah, my grandmother, she used to tell me that when I got off the airplane in Seattle after being there for like being in Italy for like a year, she said I spoke Italian. But I don't remember it. I mean, not a lot of Italian, but I could tell her that. I think I said, look at my new blue shirt. I think that's what she used to tell me, that I would say that in Italian. And I didn't. I don't know how to say that.
Wow. Now. It's also quite talkative for a two-year-old. I know
It's
one of those ages where you're rapidly developing language. I guess you were in the right place at the right time for that.
Yeah. And I mean, there could be some tall story stuff there too with a grandparent, but yeah.
Grandparents never make things up.
No, not at all.
This chili, this Eritrean food festival, or it wasn't a food festival, it was a festival with delicious food?
Yeah, it was just a community get-together. So the refugees, I don't know. I think there was something happening in Portland at the time. I mean, Portland does have a pretty strong refugee community regardless, and they always have, I think. But there was definitely a lot of Eritreans that came to Portland in the 80s during the crisis. And so there was already a community that we would go visit with. And some of the people who were there, I mean, they spoke English because they've been kind of running this program or helping run the program. And then others, some of the friends of the people that we were hosting, you know, they would all be there as well. And so it was just a really neat exchange because I think the host families would come to the community meeting or a group, and we'd eat dinner with everybody, and we got to experience their culture, but it was there in Portland. It wasn't in Africa. And yeah, they made a really large, I remember a very large pot of, I thought it was chili at the time, but it was Dorawat. And I learned about Berberi powder, the spice. And
What is Berberi powder?
But Berberi is a mix of, a lot of it is cayenne, but it's a mix of different spices. There's a touch of cinnamon in it, which gives it that kind of North African kind of flavor, I guess, if you will. And a few other, it's basically the curry, I would say, of like Ethiopia in that area. So, and every family kind of has their own version of it, but it was an amazing food meal. Plus they had injera bread, which is the fermented pancake. It's a sourdough pancake made out of, I can't remember the name of the grain, but anyway, it's injera bread is like a sourdough pancake, and you eat the Dorawat with the pancake. It's really good.
That sounds like a fantastic meal. And of course, every meal is better when you're with great people. And was this one of the few times, how often would the refugees' friends be around to, did they interpret? Were you able to learn a lot more about these people who were living with you?
That's a really good question. You know, I don't really recall. I just know that we went to a few community events, and I know that when we were there, I was able to understand more about the culture because there were people there speaking English. And I know my parents were interested and they were asking questions. And so I think when we were going to those, there's only a handful of them during that summer, but it's definitely a place where we could learn more about what our refugee friends, you know, or maybe what they were talking about. They played a lot of cards when they were at our house, and I don't know what games they were playing. And, you know, I think they were sitting there watching TV with us and just like, I don't know how much of it they were absorbing, but it's a good point because we really didn't have, you know, for 8 hours a day or whatever, or more, we were with these two people and we really didn't speak much of each other's language, and it all kind of worked. But we would learn more as we went to these community events and talked to other people.
That is so cool.
It's pretty weird. It was cool.
And of course, I know throughout your career, learning how to be empathetic, how to connect with people when it seems like you're not speaking the same language, that has helped you so much through life, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a really important for you know, near and far, and the sort of the objective here and the idea of understanding differences in people, both in your own community and people around you, but as well as elsewhere. I really think that by putting yourself in that position and meeting with people that are vastly different than you, that really brings you into another zone, into a space. And I kind of feel like if we didn't have that experience, if I don't have this experience when I was growing up like the Eritrean refugees, I feel like I might have been a little more closed in and a little less willing to step out of my comfort zone. And I know I was only a kid at the time, but I was a young teenager, so I was kind of learning experiences. I think we look back at those times in our lives, especially when you're a young teenager, and you might think that you were not really, you know, gregarious or that, you know, motivated to seek things out. But I think you look back and there's some very fond memories of those times at that age where you were doing those things. And anyway, yeah, I think that was a big part of learning empathy. Although I do think that I may already have some of that genetically. My mom was very empathetic. So, and maybe that, I don't know, maybe that was part of it too.
Were she and your dad both professors?
My mom worked, she worked in the university system and worked at consulting firms doing graphic design. She was an artist that got into more of the scientific illustration side of things. She has really neat work that she did. Some whales that she worked on, charcoal whale drawings for the British Museum when we lived in England for a year.
What?
And I tried to track them down, but I couldn't find them. They're probably in the basement of the Natural History Museum in London. But I tried to find those. And anyway, they were on display for I think a year in the large Natural History Museum in London. They were really nice, really nice looking drawings. Great stuff.
Good for her. And what did your dad do?
Yeah, so my dad was a paleontologist who studied predominantly bivalves, freshwater bivalves in Oregon. But a lot of his upbringing came from GI Bill type stuff in the 60s, and oil exploration was huge. So invertebrate paleontology is a big part of oil exploration. And that's kind of how he got interested in it. And then he just stayed in academia and was interested in research. When I think he actually was really interested in teaching. He became, I think most of his work at Portland State was more for actually teaching and some research.
When he was researching, he was combing through rock looking for these aquatic creatures, and then you ended up doing hydrogeology.
Yeah, that's an interesting...
Any connection there?
Yeah, there's a good point to that. We talked about this earlier, but before this podcast, but I was really interested in physics in high school. Had a really good instructor in high school, and I really loved the idea of studying physics. And I got to Oregon State University, and I didn't know what I was thinking. I was majoring in physics, and it was really hard. And it got very esoteric and kind of abstract. And so, and part of that was, it was just hard for me to really connect on that level. And I'd already been out to field camp with my father and other uh-huh. students. And we went on field trips together. And I just started thinking, you know, I never really thought I'd be interested in geology, but now I'm kind of interested in it. So in the middle of my physics major, I realized I got the hard classes out of the way. Let's go do geology. And it was awesome. Everybody in geology program at Oregon State were great, great to work with. It was a really neat small group of people. And from then on, I just enjoyed it. I stuck with it and ended up getting a job in consulting and then working for Oregon DEQ doing environmental geology.
Marvelous. And traveling all over both the state, this would eventually take you to Peru. And when we come back, we'll hear a ton about both of those. Near and Far Podcast is looking for future guests. If you or someone you know would like to share your stories or experiences with other listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Reach out to the show at www.nearandfar.travel. That's nearandfar.travel to tell us why you'd be great on a future episode. Before we left, we were discussing your experience hosting refugees from Eritrea as a child, and then how that helped develop your sense of empathy and relationship building skills. And then you got a job in hydrogeology at the Oregon DEQ. What do you do for them?
So I started working at Oregon DEQ after being in consulting for a few years, environmental consulting. And I've been at Oregon DEQ for about 26 years. My job has pretty much been, it's always been in the environmental cleanup program, which is kind of like Superfund, but it's the Oregon or the state version of it. So if you think of like large contaminated sites like Love Canal or those types of sites.
And the Superfund is the federal program through the EPA that remediates environmental disasters through grant funds.
Yeah, it's exactly. Sometimes they are able to get a hold of a responsible party, and the responsible party will pay for the cleanup. So under the Superfund law, CERCLA, Comprehensive Environmental Resource Conservation and Liability Act, I think that's correct. That does have a requirement that says that if you make a mess, if you pollute, you are responsible to clean it up. Now, we don't
makes
always...
Makes perfect sense.
No, yeah, it totally does. But now we don't always, are not always able to get a hold of the responsible parties. Sometimes they don't have funding, or in the case of mining, there are a lot of those folks just don't, the assets aren't available because it was a long time ago. And Oregon, as well as pretty much every state
So basically you're going over after the grandchildren of the mine owners?
Not really. No, we try to track down the assets. So some companies, those assets from mining, for example, do travel into stay with a company, and that company might move to a different name or a different different owner, but sometimes we can actually trace that to an organization still viable and still has money. But a lot of times that's tough to do in mining. In other areas, gas stations that have contamination, or maybe a wood treater that causes contamination, those are a little easier to find a relatively new responsible party that is responsible for that contamination.
You know, I would imagine these people are not super receptive to you when you show up at their door. And that's probably part of where all of this relationship building experience comes into play. But before we chat about that, your work is in mercury remediation, and Oregon is not known for mercury mines. Where does the mercury come from?
That's a really good question. So my work involves a variety of different contaminants, but I have focused a lot on mercury contamination as it relates to, predominantly as it relates to abandoned mine lands. So I think, people in the Western states like to talk about the gold mining history. As you know, California had a lot of gold mining. Oregon has had some. Nevada still has quite a bit right now. And I think what's happened is that people like to, talk about the excitement of the gold rush and all that. And it's kind of a positive historical sort of thing. People are into mm-hmm. that. It's kind of interesting. But I think what people don't realize
Of course, everybody moved out west.
Exactly.
They saw how beautiful the mountains were and then they stayed.
Yes, exactly. So I think what happens when it comes to mercury is we do have a lot of mercury mines in the Western states. In fact, California has quite a number of large ones. So does Oregon and Nevada and a few others. I think what's kind of happened is we don't really, those are kind of a scar, and people don't really really want to talk about the mercury that we used to mine and the contamination that it's left. Now, gold mines in themselves, just from amalgamation, the use of mercury to refine gold or silver, you do tend to get quite a bit of mercury contamination from that because people bring it into those sites and use it at the gold sites.
Okay, so you have a gold mine, and before you can turn it into a usable product, you need to also mine mercury, then bring it to the gold mine for refining.
Exactly.
And amalgamation is the word you said?
Amalgamation.
Amalgamation.
Yeah, so...
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, just like the silver mercury fillings that we have. That's an amalgamation of basically, I think it's 50% silver and 50% mercury. And those two combine together, just like gold, you can do it with gold. Gold and mercury can be combined together, and they can kind of create this kind of spongy, kind of hard but malleable type material. So anyway, we have mercury mines in the Western states. We have gold mines in the Western states. They're not necessarily right next to each other. They usually aren't. Gold and mercury is usually in sort of a different area. But you end up getting contamination around the mercury mines, quite a bit of contamination because of the processing that took place. But you also have potential contamination of mercury at gold mines as well. It just depends on how much was used and if they were, not all gold mines necessarily used it or needed to use it. But it does help the refining process with really fine particulate gold or silver.
How do you know if a mine has extensive mercury contamination?
We look at the records. A lot of the U.S. Bureau of Mines and the state geology departments, mining permit departments, they have records for a lot of this. They're not really, really great records, but a lot of times if you dig through some of those older reports, they'll talk about a particular mine, and at that mine, you'll hear about somebody bringing in a mercury. They might say, we used copper plates. Copper plates is the same idea. You'd put mercury on the plates, put it in a sluice box where the water flows through with the fine-grained crushed ore, and the mercury will adsorb, basically, the gold. It'll amalgamate, and then you can get all of that mercury and gold off. It's heavier because of the mercury, and then you can gravitationally separate it easier in either a pan or another sluice or other type of device.
And maybe I'm not super familiar with the mining process, but pouring water through a sluice box with mercury sounds like water is always going to flow downhill, and will it take the mercury with it?
Yeah, it does.
Is that the reason your job exists?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, that is the reason for, like, at least for gold mines, you know, gold and silver, that is the reason why you do have contamination moving downstream. But you also have volatilization of mercury from that site. So, yeah, so mercury at standard temperature and pressure, basically right now, is always volatilizing. So if we had mercury in front of us, elemental mercury, it would be volatilizing. The more heat you put towards it, the faster it's going to volatilize, the more it's going to volatilize off. One of the processes in the mercury amalgamation process for mining is a lot of times, especially in developing countries right now and historically in the United States, the mercury would just be cooked off. You just burn off that sponge material of gold and mercury, and the mercury goes away into the atmosphere, and then what's left is the gold. So that is going up in the atmosphere. A lot of times it's landing kind of nearby, but it also can go all the way into the atmosphere, and it can travel around the globe. And that is actually why we have a lot of gold, mercury. That's why we have a lot of mercury impacts now, where you wouldn't expect to see them. You're getting mercury from global atmospheric deposition getting into reservoirs, lakes, and that kind of thing, far away from where the actual source of the mercury is.
Wow, that's so troubling. And at least in the community near the mine, it creates jobs, and there's kind of a trade-off. But if this mercury is raining on me, I didn't get any benefit from that.
Yeah, and I should say it. I mean, raining. It is actually literally raining. I mean, there's data that shows.
Oh, so it is raining. Yeah.
Yeah. In precipitation, you can measure the amount of mercury coming out of the atmosphere in precipitation. But the important thing to understand is that that's at very low concentrations. And from a human health, ingestion or human health perspective, where you're interacting with it, it's really, really low. It's unlikely to cause any impacts. It's the fish that you eat from those reservoirs and those lakes. That's where it's been bioaccumulating and becoming more and more content. You know, it's getting more and more concentrated as you move up the food chain. And then when you eat those larger fish, that's where it becomes a risk to human health.
Okay. And so this explains why you need to travel around Oregon, connecting with these mine owners and the whoever is responsible, whichever states are responsible in the current day. And they're probably not super receptive to see you. They're probably not excited. And yeah, I'm just trying to picture what it must be like to go into those regions and say, hello, I'm here to find you and clean up your environment.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I know where you're headed. So not just in my job in the cleanup program, and not just on mercury mines or mines, but basically any regulatory agency, especially an environmental regulatory agency, the bread and butter of that agency is to essentially regulate and use the rules and the statutes to essentially make sure that the environment stays clean and doesn't get contaminated. Mm-hmm. And so in my small world, you know, I work on the cleanup sites have already been contaminated, and we go try to get the current property owner or a past property owner or an operator that caused the contamination. We try to get them to do the cleanup. That doesn't always work. People don't want to give us access because they don't want us to come in and say, hey, you got to clean up this mess. And that's very problematic. I will say, I think, from a sort of an empathetic or an awareness perspective, I do feel like I have, I don't know if it's just because I am, I feel like I'm very empathetic, but I want to hear their side of the story, and I want to understand where they're coming from. And I get it. If you go out and buy a piece of property, you think that there's no problem with it, and then someone comes along and says, hey, there's a problem here, and you're responsible. And you're like, but I didn't even cause that problem. I totally understand where they're coming from. Our law does say that they're still responsible, so that's kind of a problem. But I think the key to that is to just listen, understanding where they're coming from, understand their circumstances around, you know, how they got the property and they may actually, you know, and I think the other thing that's really important is that they don't want to be making a mess. They do want to clean up the environment. They may not have the money to do it, but a lot of the people I work with in the rural areas, they do care about their neighbors, and they care about the environment. And I think that's one of the things we forget about. I think it's important for us to understand where these people are coming from and why they have those perspectives. And, you know, we don't always see eye to eye, but it does bring us closer, at least in conversation. And it does help us at least understand what their issues are. And we try to work with them in that regard. So yeah, I think empathy is important.
Yeah, empathy, especially there. I don't know how you would even be able to do your job without empathy, without being able to find that common ground of everybody wanting to do the right thing. So when we come back from this short break, you're going to take everything that you've learned from this ODEQ job and travel to Peru. You worked with a colonial Golden Mercury mine, right?
Yeah, I've worked on a Spanish colonial mine. It's not operating now, but it did cause a lot of contamination over the last several
Well,
centuries.
I'm excited to hear about this. We will be right back. So many places to go, so many things to see. Wherever you are, make it easy to find more interviews like this one. Near and Far's free monthly newsletter will keep you up to speed about the latest podcast episodes, as well as our hand-picked recommendations. That's only one email per month. To sign up, simply follow the link in the show notes or head over to www.nearandfar.travel/newsletter. Bren, tell us about Peru. Like, what brought you there?
Yeah, my interest in mining, my interest in cleaning up mine sites in Oregon, it brought me to a certain space. I'd always wanted to be in the Peace Corps. My wife and I both had wanted to do that kind of stuff. I think, again, the cultural experiences I had when I was younger made me want to do more of that kind of work. But it didn't really pan out in my early career. And so my wife and I basically had kids and had jobs and got a house and did everything we normally would do. And then at the ripe old age of 40, I don't know, five, I think, maybe a little younger than that, I started looking into trying to do some kind of international work. And so
Oh.
I really enjoy the work I do at Oregon DEQ. I'm still doing it, but I felt like I wanted to do similar work internationally. And I ended up getting a hold of the executive director of a group called the Environmental Health Council. It's a very small NGO that works in predominantly in Peru. Well, they're in Peru now, but we have looked at trying to do work elsewhere. And it all kind of came from a Spanish colonial mercury mine, essentially the largest
Oh.
mercury mine in the Western Hemisphere, in Huancavelica, Peru, which is the Santa Barbara mine. And this mine was essentially used by the Spanish during the 1700s, 1800s, and on, well, I guess about till the end of the 1800s, to essentially amalgamate silver at the large Cerro Rico silver mine in Potosi, Bolivia. And that's where the Spanish headquarters was. So
Ooh-ha.
when the Spanish came to the Western world, Western Hemisphere, they were essentially looking for gold and silver. And they were actually bringing mercury from Albion, Spain, which is the largest mercury mine
Oh.
in the world. They would bring it across the ocean and use it to amalgamate silver and gold in various areas in the Western, in Mexico and other parts of Latin America. And they found this mercury site in Huancavelica and realized it would be a lot easier to use the local population, the Incas. And essentially enslave them and use them to not only mine and remove the ore from the mountain, but also crush it and put it into furnaces, and then take it over to Potosi, Bolivia, where they would essentially use it. They'd amalgamate the silver ore, crushed silver ore, with the mercury in very poor conditions. And that's how they got a lot of the silver out, was by using that mercury.
Wow.
So Huancavelica is extremely
Wow. In
contaminated.
addition,
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
not only was the work in awful conditions, but then they probably ended up with such terrible health problems because of the mercury exposure.
Yes, it's yeah, it was terrible conditions. And the executive director, Dr. Nicholas Robbins, who for the EHC has written on this subject quite a bit. And that's actually how he got involved with it. He was studying Latin American history and found this environmental disaster essentially, and has created the NGO, the Environmental Health Council. And I got involved. And so he and I and others, a few others, have been spending quite a bit of time in the last, I guess, 15 years trying to identify the extent of the contamination in Huancavelica. We've been looking at some other colonial sites in Peru as well. And there's definitely contamination is still there, and people are being exposed to very high concentrations of mercury and lead and arsenic. Those are the two other
Oh, wow.
co-contaminants that you often get in these types of sites.
How many hundreds of years ago was this mined?
This was 1700s, was the majority of the work was around the 1700s, some of it in the 1800s as well. And I think some of it even was happening more in a more current industrial. Well, in fact, we know that. They're actually up at the mine site. There's some newer equipment, a newer rotary furnace that's very similar to the kind of stuff that we have in Oregon from the 40s, 1940s, 1950s, that kind of stuff. So they were actually doing the same thing at Santa Barbara mine probably up until the 60s.
Is there still mercury in that mine, or like clearly there was enough to make it worth hauling equipment up there in the 60s?
Yeah, no, it's definitely it was definitely profitable at one time. But I think that, you know, one thing is to keep in mind is that mercury, since the Minamata disease and the big Minamata disaster in Japan in the 50s, where people were being exposed to methylmercury, once that got a kind of out in the open and people realized what had happened and what was going on, mercury use really, really stopped a lot. I mean, most of the mercury mines in Oregon and California stopped operating in the 60s and 70s. And then I think the last one in the United States was maybe in the 90s in southeastern Oregon or northeastern Nevada. But basically, mercury is a very toxic element. And I think just at least in the United States and then other countries were realizing it was too toxic to use. And so a lot of its use was decreased in the 60s and 70s. It's still being used today, actually, in artisanal small-scale gold mining in developing countries where they're still using it for predominantly gold amalgamation.
Well, let's pivot just a little bit. So in Peru, you're doing largely the same work that you're doing in Oregon, but just in a very, very different setting. Can you paint the picture? What's Huacofilica like?
Yeah, it's basically the exact same type of work. And in fact, what's really interesting is the rules in Peru might be a little bit different than they are in Oregon and the United States, but essentially the process of assessing contamination, looking at exposure to people, and then trying to figure out a cleanup, some kind of mitigation or cleanup plan, it's the same process. So that's really neat to be able to take all of my experience that I've got from Oregon and go to other countries, in this case Peru, and follow the same plan. It's a little more short-circuited because we don't have all the funding that we might have working in the United States. So we have to kind of make do with limited equipment or with a little less data. But in really contaminated places, it doesn't take much to really know that people are being exposed.
And then you travel thousands of miles and the landowners that you're speaking with, do they pretty much have the exact same concerns as the ones back home?
Not always. Yeah, as you might imagine, in a developing country, there's more interest from the average person in just getting through the day, feeding their family, and making money, right? So they may not have quite as much interest or awareness about the potential contamination that they're living in and around. And so one of our objectives, at least at the EHC, is to work with local community folks, whether it's a hospital or medical staff, and try to get local government organizations, to try to get the information out to the people so that they understand what they are being exposed to. So in the case of Huancavelica, people have homes that are built out of adobe. The adobe is the local soil that was contaminated from the last 200 years of mercury mining and from mercury furnace operations, where you get the fallout of those heavy metals into the soil. They build the home with the adobe, and the adobe is basically just, it's not really, there's no stucco, there's no concrete. It's earthen interior buildings, and so they're being exposed to high concentrations of contaminated dust all the time, and they don't know that. And so one of our objectives is to try to get people to understand that. And when you do that, you can actually create some interventions with just outreach and just knowledge, just letting people know, you know, that you try to keep their kids from maybe crawling around on the floor, or if they have enough money to put a concrete floor in, they could do that, or maybe stucco the walls. So there's certain things we can do, and we want to try to do it that isn't really expensive, that helps the people just get a little, you know, get into a little cleaner environment. And yeah, and working with the locals, a lot of folks don't want to hear about this. And so we can't just come in there like, you know, Americans, hey, you're living in contamination. We obviously have to work with the local folks to try to get, you know, have a connection.
Right. And to find solutions that are attainable for them.
Right, yeah.
So Huancavelica is not a wealthy community. If you're walking down like the central plaza, what do you see?
Yeah, good question. The department of Huancavelica, which is essentially a province or state, is the poorest department in Peru. And the city of Huancavelica is the I guess the county seat, if you will, the provincial seat for that province. And it's a lot like a lot of Peru outside of, basically outside of the financial district of Lima. A lot of Peru is very similar, has a very similar look to it. In Huancavelica, there, you know, you're going to have concrete roads, and the city is trying to put in concrete and asphalt road, well, mostly concrete roads. They know that there's contamination in the streets. They want to cover them up. So they actually have a pretty, I wouldn't say prosperous, but I'd say they have a city government. They have a public works department, an attempt to try to get things cleaner. They have a wastewater treatment facility. But basically, the city is a very charming city. There's a lot of families out and about, walking around. Kids are out playing in the plaza. There's vendors in various places selling their goods. A lot of times there are the I don't know what you call them, but it's kind of like it's like two bicycle wheels under a fairly large wheelbarrow type system that can carry a lot of stuff. I've seen people put mattresses on the top of these things, 15 mattresses tall, and they'll just pull these down through the streets and sell their mattresses. Oh, wow. Or they're hauling them back and forth to different storefronts and stuff. But a lot of people, you know, they have cell phones and there's cars coming and going, and they're kind of, you know, they're not the newest and greatest car necessarily.
So if I were to visit Huancavelica as a tourist, I would go to the Central Plaza, see all of these. Like, it would just be like a town with Peruvian food, adobe buildings, and otherwise normal life. I probably wouldn't have any idea that it was also the site of all of this mining contamination.
Exactly.
And apart from that, are you ever able to take off your DEQ hat and just experience the culture there?
Well, yeah. So my DEQ hat stays at home anyway, because it's Oregon DEQ, but
it's a different shade of DEQ.
Yeah, right. I know what you're saying. I just want to make sure no one's like, so DEQ sends you down to... No.
No, thanks for clarifying.
Yeah, so I think, and this gets to kind of that cultural exchange piece. So I like to be a tourist. I think we all kind of like to go be tourists and see things, but I don't feel like you get quite the same cultural exchange as a tourist. If you're working in the community and you're going to like in the case of Huancavelica, you know, in the main plaza, yeah, sure, it's a really nice, beautiful little town, and there's old colonial buildings, and there's really neat, you know, festivals that are going on and parades and all that. But as you move into the poorer parts of the city of Huancavelica, that's where you end up coming into these places where people are living in in poorer conditions, where they're living in adobe homes, where they don't have quite the nicest, they won't have stucco on the walls, so they won't have concrete on the floor. And that's where we're usually going, because that's where we know where people are being exposed to the most contamination. And so I guess when we work with a local doctor or a local archaeologist, for example, that's who we have on our team, they live there and they are meeting with all of these folks all the time. They're going to some of these parts of the town. You really do experience a different part of the city and a different culture, I guess, than the culture you'd get as a tourist. And in fact, I don't know. I just don't think a lot of people go to the city of Huancavelica to tour, because it's just not really...
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, people want to go see the mine at times, and people might want to go see a festival or something. But generally speaking, you can see a lot of... That's a very similar culture throughout the Andes that's a lot like that. So if you go to Cusco, which is the common Andean sort of culture that most people from the United States or elsewhere go, they're going to Machu Picchu, they're going to Cusco. They're seeing all of that stuff there, and they may not have an interest to really see any of their small towns. But what's really neat when we go to some of these other towns like Huancavelica or Huancayo or Huamachuco, I'm seeing different cultures just within those little towns. To me, that is really interesting. I'm seeing different textiles, the mantas that the women carry the babies and potatoes well, not just women, everybody uses it to carry. It's like the backpack. Huancavelica has its own textile pattern that they use. And then if you go to Huamachuco, it's a different style up northern part. Or if you go to Cusco, it's a different part.
Is it different in the way that like Scottish tartans are
very similar.
Different, so.
Yeah. So anyway, and then the food is probably all fairly similar, but you'll see a slightly different difference in that too. But I think, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that even in, so when you go to be in a, as a tourist, oftentimes it's fairly short. You're seeing what they expect you to see for as being a tourist. Mm. And when you go to work or to go to the areas where people aren't trying to show you the tourism, you're seeing the culture and
the genuine
like, culture.
It's not curated.
Exactly. And yeah. I truly appreciate that. I really, and again, it gets back to sort of the retreat thing. I can't speak. My Spanish is not very good. I try to learn Quechua and I can learn a few words in Quechua, which is the native language there. And it's really fun to try to learn some of that with people in the hills. They laugh at me and I make mistakes all the time. But it's just an amazing experience. And it's so much better for me, it's just so much better to experience it that way than to be a tourist for a few days in one spot.
Yeah, of course. I'm not sure I would have enough days off to be able to go and spend enough time in each town just to realize things like the different textile patterns. That must be so cool, being that immersed in the culture.
That's a good point. And I haven't even been there. So when I go there, I only go there for like 2 weeks at a time. It's just that I've done it for 10 years or more. And so, and we've gone to a few different areas. And I'm also working with a historian that really absorbs this stuff. And working with the local folks, they like to talk about these things. And I'm always having to get someone to interpret for me. But I just think it's when you're working in that arena, you really are seeing the genuine side of things.
Fantastic. And I know we're approaching time. Wanted to make sure we had another moment just to talk about the EHC, the Environmental Health Council, that's running this remediation effort in Wakafalika.
Yeah, so we are very small. I mentioned that earlier. And the Environmental Health Council is a very small NGO. We have the executive director, who's a historian, Latin American historian, and then a physician who works out of Lima, but has spent a lot of time in Huancavelica, and an archaeologist who lives in Huancavelica, who speaks Quechua. And with that team, we've really done quite a bit of work. We've worked with the local hospital, and their staff have helped us out. They've collected blood samples, and they've helped us communicate with people and try to get access to homes. It's been it's just a really great group of people. But the Environmental Health Council is very small, and we've tried to get some funding through grants, and we haven't gotten much in regard with that. But one of the things we have done is we've worked with a large, well, I shouldn't say large, but it's called the Environmental Law Defense Center, and they basically are an NGO that works around the world to try to find lawyers within the local communities that are impacted. And then we would work with that individual lawyer to try to get a lawsuit going if need be. So we've tried to work with the Ministry of Environment, the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Housing in Peru, and we haven't gotten very far. So the community members, with our assistance and with the attorney's assistance, they basically sued the federal government of Peru, and we actually won the lawsuit. But we're still waiting for the lawsuits basically says that the executive branch needs to do something about this. And
we know executive branches love listening to judicial branches.
Exactly. And so in this particular case, the lawsuit does say that the Ministry of Environment, and I believe the Ministry of Health, need to do something about the contamination. But it's been slow going. So anyway, we still want to, do more work down there and still assess and determine, find out who's at risk and show the world that there is contamination that people are living in. And we have been doing work on other sites that have colonial impacts as well in Peru.
So what can we as just bystanders do to either learn more about the EHC or help support the mission?
Well, the one thing you can do is look at our website, and I probably should have had that URL right there where you go, but it's pretty easy to find if you do a search for the Environmental Health Council and Mercury Cleanup in Peru.
Looks like mercurycleanup.org.
That's right.
The right one?
That's right. That's specific to Juan Cavalica. Thank you.
Oh.
And you can donate. We do have a connection there where you can donate funds to the program. Most recently, the funding we've used that we've gotten from small donations is to actually put stucco on walls and concrete on floors of
Oh.
homes that have contamination in them, and people are living in these, adobe homes where you've got a lot of dust and stuff. That's the biggest thing we can do, I think, the most important and pretty much the easiest way to reduce the exposure of mercury, arsenic, and lead from people ingesting dust in their homes is by putting a layer of stucco on the walls and putting concrete down the floors. Because a lot of these homes, they have just earthen floors and earthen walls.
Do you have any estimate what somebody could donate that would, or how much someone would have to donate to appropriately stucco one room or one house?
I believe we did, I think for $500, I think we got about two or three houses. And I'm not saying people need to donate that kind of money, but anything, $20, $25, whatever, anything helps. And the other thing we could use funding for is to actually assess other sites in Peru. One of the biggest problems we have is getting access to a field portable XRF, X-ray fluorescence device is the XRF. Basically, these are $40,000 devices that can get you pretty good detection limits for heavy metals. And so you can get, it's
Oh.
like a tricorder, like on Star Trek. You can basically go out in the field, and within a matter of a minute, you can basically find out the concentrations of heavy metals in soil. And so we borrow an XRF, or we have rented in the past. But anyway, if we could get funding to get something like that, that would be an amazing step forward for assessing not just Huancavelica, but any of the colonial contaminated sites in Peru and elsewhere too.
With that, I've learned so much from you in this episode tonight. Thanks, Bryn, for being on the show. And thank you for listening to the Near and Far podcast. If you liked this conversation, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your fellow explorers. You can find more episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, nearandfar.travel, YouTube, or wherever you enjoy your favorite podcasts. I'm your host, Zachary Ellis. Stay curious, stay adventurous, and stay exploring. Near and far.